Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
I'm not the one licking the dagger for the reference today.
I am licking a Peter Lyon masterpiece.
It's
here.
A lovely little, is that a hobbit sword?
This is from Farewell to Arms, our video we made with Weta Workshop.
The short film.
Cool. Absolutely.
A year ago, almost exactly.
I assisted Peter in making this dagger, but make no mistake, this is a Peter Lyon dagger.
This is not your dagger.
I did some of the busy work.
What's the thing at the bottom of the hilt? Is that the pommel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The way that those swords, I feel like one of the other swords that you have that's a Lord of the Rings sword does that same thing, where it's like a gentle, like a conical,
Boromir sword does the same finish at the end.
It's gorgeous.
It is. And one of the things that's beautiful about watching Peter go is he makes measurements and he works to keep to those measurements, but not as assiduously as he works to make them work with each other.
Mm.
So it's like when you watch him, it's like you look at the Hobbit sword, you look at the sting, right? And you think there's this canon perfect sting. And there is, but at the same time, with each one he makes, it's like he's adjusting a curve here to fit this curve, like these tiny subtleties that you probably would have a hard time even calling out with a ruler, but create this balance within all the pieces together.
In that way, it's not best produced. Every pommel and hilt are made for each other.
That's what I think. That's what I have feel like I've learned watching him go.
But
we're jumping right into it.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because that's the same feeling I had. You did a series of boxes in like 2013 or 2014, mm-hmm. probably, where you made just.
I made boxes for everything.
If you had it here and you wanted to be able to carry it around, you made a box for it.
Mm-hmm.
And watching you, like, you would start out with what your basic measurements would be, and then you'd start putting it together and it wouldn't fit right. And you'd be like, oh, okay, I fixed this, and just run it through the bandsaw real quick. And you know, like, but at the end, the box was right for the thing that it was supposed to hold.
Right.
But sometimes you were looking at it and was like, how is this going to work out? Oh, okay, you'll get there. Yeah.
I really appreciate the kind of, I watch a lot of online builds. It's almost exclusively what I watch. And I watch a lot of people pre-plan stuff in CAD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate people who can do that because it's a very effective method when I see people execute it. And yet for me, it has to be this organic process of kind of adjusting the pieces to each other. If I'm making a box for a sword, I got to have the sword on the table the whole time. There's no part of me that could take a picture or a 3D representation of that sword and build a box for it virtually. I have to kind of do it actively.
Well, it's a physicality to it.
Yeah, and it's not that one is better than the other. It's just that that's the way I'm built.
Well, and part of it is that you learned a lot of your stuff in a place where materials weren't particularly scarce.
Yes.
For example, when you were at ILM, time was the valuable resource and you guys were burning materials and everything else to get to do the most you could in the time you had.
To be sure.
And that definitely is carried over to your current style of building, I think.
Yes. But we're ignoring the most important thing that happened this week.
Okay.
Which is that Terry Gross said my name.
I listened to that interview this morning on the way in here. Because Gina said, as I was leaving the house, oh, by the way, Adam was on Terry Gross yesterday. I was like, wait, what? How did you not lead with this?
The show is called Fresh Air.
Fresh Air. Sorry.
Fresh Air. Terry Gross's Fresh Air. I've been listening to it since its inception.
WHYY. Philadelphia.
From WHYY in Philadelphia. I love Terry so much. Fresh I love that whole
she's,
show.
She's the best radio voice, I think, working today.
She really did. She's my ASMR safe space.
Yeah, yeah.
A producer on her show interviewed me about Mythbusters Jr. in a wide-ranging interview that's up on freshair.com. You can go listen to it
in your favorite podcast app
or your favorite podcast
your
app.
Your Codpast app is Codpast. A different thing.
It was a lovely interview. I'm really happy with how it came out. I went over here to the KQED offices in Potrero Hill to record it, and we spent about, I don't know, the better part of an hour, maybe 55 minutes, and they cut it into that like 28-minute, 26-minute piece.
It's really interesting for radio shows how the behind-the-scenes, because I know like Simone did TED Radio Hour, and that one is a different type of conversation because it also splices in from her TED Talk.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, everyone does a different style. You record the picking up the phone. Does it make it, is it like dialing
right,
a person?
Right.
Or is it supposed to be like the in-studio formal interview? And this is more that.
This was very much that. And very much, look, Fresh Air is it's a terrific machine for interviewing people and diving deep. And so In this one, the questions they asked were probing. The research they'd done was extensive. That's always a real delight when you're talking to someone who's done a deep amount of homework. Not that I mind. I mean, you know, it's all just talking about yourself, right? So it's not like this bandwidth is a fairly narrow one.
But it's fun, like having heard a lot of people interview you over the years. Like, it's fun when they ask questions that are both new questions. Or new, brand new questions, or questions that approach from a different angle than you've ever heard before.
He asked a specific question, which was, "What is it about you that drove Jamie crazy?" And a lot of people don't ask that.
You always hear the other one. Why do you and Jamie not like each other?
Right. They looked for a different way to ask that.
You are a professional interviewer. You've done it on stage. Mm-hmm. You've done it for all sorts of things. All three of us have mm-hmm. done it in some professional capacity. I think of it as a dance. Every time.
Mm-hmm.
It is a dance with a new partner, sometimes it's a dance with the same partner.
Mm-hmm.
And where when Will and I have gone to shows and mm-hmm. we've interviewed maybe the same person. Yeah,
you've interviewed Nate Mitchell a dozen times at this point, right?
And then check in a year later, it's like dancing with someone,
mm-hmm.
a familiar dance with maybe new steps or a new song. But there are beats to it, there's give and take.
And just like a dance, there's got to be some improvisation. Yeah. So you always write out all your questions, and you write out way more than you need. And then you end up using 5-10% of those questions, but to have them in your head so that when they say something and you have a great follow-up,
yeah.
that's what the part of it that feels as fresh as dancing can feel.
And for people who are on the receiving side of an interviewee, there's the range of there's the person who may or may not have been interviewed before or maybe not be comfortable. And we've all...
Yeah.
interacted with those people.
Right, and we've all been that person, too.
Exactly. Yeah. And how do you make them comfortable in this dance? So the person who their job is to be interviewed and they're on maybe a circuit, and how do you make it interesting for them?
Well, interviewing other people professionally is real. Interviewing other people is hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult work. I spend most of my time terrified. My brain is going to draw a complete blank when it's time for another question. And it gave me a lot of... sympathy, and it gave me a lot of empathy for my interlocutors when I encounter them.
Well,
you know,
but at the same time, it's really fun to prepare for those interviews. Like when you were doing Talking Room and Norm and I would help you, like you were still shooting Mythbusters, so you didn't have time to go back and watch six movies or,
mm-hmm.
you know, read every interview with Jason Reitman that had been published in the last 5 years. So you could figure out what people had asked and what they hadn't, mm-hmm. where they hadn't gotten to. And it was really, really fun. Like normally the stuff that Norm and I were doing, we would have the background information, and then we would ask some questions of the PR people or the technical people or whatever before we do an interview. But kind of there wasn't a lot of time to do deep prep.
Right.
And getting to do deep prep like they do on a show like Fresh Air is super duper fun.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. So what's going on this week? I will tell you, I've been watching lots of comfort movies.
Okay.
And by comfort movies, I'm saying we've been watching movies that are familiar and excellent. And so we've watched Casino Royale.
Mm-hmm.
So hold on, let's go back to this comfort movie thing before we get down to the list. You're looking for movies that you know you're not going to be disappointed by.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that are familiar enough that you're going to... like you can look for deeper beats and find new mm-hmm. things in.
Yep.
But do you want to see from beginning to end, and it's not okay stop?
In general, no, it's fine to stop. Oh, okay. Julie and I both, we're stoppers. We pause to talk about what's going on. We converse, we criticize.
But you wouldn't feel bummed out, or you would feel bummed out if something happened. You're like, oh, we can't finish the last 30 minutes of this movie. Or you commit.
No. We certainly leave the last 30. Okay. I mean, yeah, totally. We're fine about stopping. So it's comfortingly excellent movies from the past.
Okay.
So like a couple months ago, I watched Out of Sight.
That is a fantastic film.
Dude, it is a perfect movie.
It's aged really well, too.
It is aged really well. It is weird to be almost 15 years older now than George Clooney was in that movie.
I still feel like even in that movie, like except for the very early episodes of ER that Clooney was on, I feel like any Clooney in film is always going to be older than I am at this moment.
Nope, it's right? not. That's new. You watch this and that subverts that paradigm.
Oh no!
Yeah, no, it's bizarre. So we watched Casino Royale with Daniel Craig and Eva Green, which is still terrific, despite having the worst poker game in any movie.
And that is one, I think, where it drags a little bit toward the end. It's much stronger in the first two thirds than I think in the last third. Once they get to them on vacation in Venice. And
you know what? I will point out to you, I think I might have agreed with you in the abstract, but that whole vacation in Venice to the denouement of her betrayal, spoilers.
It's a 10-year-old movie.
It happens much quicker than you think. Those beats are tight.
To me, the long part of that movie is the poker. Is the from the
but
first time they play
enjoyable
poker
for all those scowling.
It's so bad.
Again, the movie's better than I remembered. And Mads Mikkelsen, who I got to meet last year at Silicon Valley Comic Con, his son, he was there with his kid, and his son was a fan of the show. And Mads Mikkelsen is so nice. And so sweet. And I got to say to him, you are my favorite Bond villain.
No doubt.
When he says the thing, nothing sinister, and he's bleeding from the eye. That's the perfect Bond villain.
So good.
That and the scene where Bond gets poisoned while he's playing poker and has to go do the thing and has like 8 minutes or something. They don't explicitly come out and say, hey, the clock's ticking. But the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking, and then they use a coincidence to get him out.
Yeah.
Which drives me crazy.
But sometimes coincidence. Sometimes
this
being
is
lucky
this
helps.
Is a Pixar axiom. It's okay to use a coincidence to get your hero into trouble. It is not okay to use a coincidence to get them out of trouble.
But part of Bond's thing is that he's lucky.
Sure. No, I get that.
Like,
I get that. Like, and I'm fully up with Issa Rae playing the lucky one in Deadpool 2.
Yeah, Zazie Beetz.
I'm getting. I didn't see the movie. I only saw the trailer, so I'm going off of information.
Rob Delaney has a really good part in that movie.
Oh, okay.
It's worth watching for the Rob Delaney part.
All right, that whole humor is weirdly lost on me. I feel like I'm just too old for it. But
maybe.
But all that being said. Speaking of coincidences getting your hero out of trouble, there is no bigger violator of this than the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo book series and the subsequent movie series.
I've never read or I've never engaged with any of that.
Oh, okay. So first of all, the books are very readable, and there's three written by the original author published post-mortem. And they're... I'm sorry to say this. They're terrible books. I mean, they're good.
They're trashy, pulpy. They're potboilers. Yes.
Yeah. With... Like, the number of coincidences that help Lisbeth Salander get out of trouble is so myriad and exhausting. It's ridiculous.
It's written as a book where the chapter end and every chapter end is a cliffhanger.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But the movies are great.
Are you talking about the American ones or the Swedish ones?
I've watched them all.
Okay.
So I watched all three Swedish ones. I watched the David Fincher one, which I love. I love all of them. And I also just watched the Claire Foy one, The Girl Who Kicked the Spider's Web. It's the same amount of terrible and great. Claire Foy is fantastic.
Claire Foy is really, really good and everything.
She's wonderful. Yeah. And again, lots of coincidences to get her out of trouble.
Okay. The villain in that one, Sylvia Hoyt, is Love in Blade Runner 2049.
Hold on. Is she the robot?
Love.
The hologram?
No.
The android prostitute.
No, the villain.
That's right. I was trying to remember how I knew her.
Oh,
thank you.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. I couldn't figure out how I knew her. That is so awesome. That took me longer than it should have to figure all that out. We also watched Silence of the Lambs. Now,
Comfort. Demi.
I know. Comfort is a weird term.
Yeah. We have to talk, Adam.
No,
I have some thoughts about what you find comfortable. There's a couple of scenes in Casino Royale that are pretty uncomfortable, you know, and then all the cannibalism do you hear the lambs, Clarice?
Here's the thing about Silence of the Lambs. Jonathan Demme is so amazing, RIP. I mean, he's so incredible. And we talked about Swimming to Cambodia and Stop Making Sense on the podcast because those are two amazing films. But as a narrative filmmaker, Silence of the Lambs is a perfect movie, and it's a deeply feminist film. Mm. So imagine this. There's a point at which Clarice and Scott Glenn, her boss, go to there's a body that's been found in the river. They go to the together representing the FBI, and then he pulls the police chief aside and he says, "I need to talk to you away from like the women," meaning Clarice Starling, played by Jodie Foster,
rookie FBI,
right? And then there's a scene where she's standing there, kind of like the young female rookie, staring at all these cops that are, you know, sexist and don't care about.
And
her.
This is like what, like 1993, supposed to take place in the late 80s, I think.
But I mean, yeah. So it's a 25-year-old film, right? And after that, they're in the car, and he says to her, "Look, you know, I had to do that. I just had to get him out of our hair." And she goes, "Yeah, but they all watch what you do to see how to behave. It matters." Just that. And then he hears that and they move on. This is a deeply a woke little movie about female empowerment and being present with your competence and knowing and trusting yourself. It's way more that than I remembered. Mm. I can't remember whether it's Tony Joe or somebody else that did a breakdown of Demi's technique of reverse angle conversations, where instead of over the shoulder angles for conversations, he went to direct character staring directly into frame.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, podcast listeners, but I seem to remember a video explicating that Demi really explored this technique more than most other directors have had in the past, of putting the audience. So there's this point at which the conversations go from side conversations where the characters are looking off camera to being shunk, and that the important parts of the conversation happen while the characters
are they spiking the camera? Or are they like looking just to the left or just
no,
to
they're
the
looking
right?
directly down the barrel.
So I need to go very uncomfortable.
Yeah. So the point at which Clarice and her partner, the other FBI female FBI agent, realize that Buffalo Bill is knew the first victim. That conversation, they're looking off camera until the last like five lines, and then they're like, "Clarice, he knew him." And they're staring right at you, and you're part of that conversation. And they do the same thing with the Clarice Lecter conversations. Mm-hmm. It's a stunning, such a good movie.
I remember seeing that movie in the theater and being so uncomfortable by the Hannibal Lecter, by Anthony Hopkins talking to Clarice. Because he's talking to you.
Yeah.
I need to go back and rewatch that. It's been a long time since I've seen that movie.
It's an education in pacing and drama. And at this point, the Hannibal Lecter stuff has become so culturally ingrained, it's no longer disturbing. I mean, it's messed up.
It's pretty lightweight compared to modern.
But it's been riffed on
horror.
So much that they are awareness of it all. And he's not even in that film that much.
Apparently, he and Jodie Foster only ever saw each other through that plexiglass.
Wow. Really?
Like on set, they only ever interacted through that plexiglass.
Yeah. Movies.
Gina and I have been going through Academy Award nom movies the last couple of weeks.
For this year. Okay.
And watched A Simple Favor.
Yes.
It's
Paul Feig.
Feig, Anna Kendrick, and
Blake Lively.
Blake Lively, thanks.
What is the premise?
So, it's like...
They sold it as Paul Feig's dark movie, and he did Bridesmaids, he did the last Ghostbusters film, and it's...
Inspired, I think.
Yes, and I think this one's also co-written by... is it Gillian Flynn? Is it the Gone Girl writer, I
want to say it's based on a book, maybe? I don't know.
But
I don't remember.
But it's in that vein. It has, mm-hmm. It's a
dark comedy.
Dark comedy Gone Girl.
It's about a woman who is deeply self-centered, who asks her friend to pick up her kid after school and then just disappears.
The roles are delicious.
And it is about characterizations. It reminds me a little bit of what was the Nicole Kidman movie where she was the weather girl?
To
Die For. It's a little bit like there's a little bit of a media
Gus
commentary
Van Zandt?
There.
Is that correct? Is that Gus Van Zandt film?
I'd have to look. I think it is. Maybe.
What did they get nominated for?
I can't remember. It's screenplay or something. I don't know. Gina wanted to watch it, and it was on our list. So.
Okay. If all the Academy Award nominated films.
Well, so a lot of them aren't available so much yet.
Yeah.
So
That's a good one.
It was interesting. It was not at all what I was expecting. It was very good.
It was very good.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
It was.
It's hilarious.
It is very, very funny. And
in a dry way.
Very,
you saw
very
it too.
Grim.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Yes. I saw it in theaters last year.
Anna Kendrick plays like a mommy blogger, and everybody has a lot of baggage, and it's very, very, very dark.
I love
and very
Anna
funny.
Kendrick. I think
she's great. She's the best. Yeah.
I also have been watching Russian Doll.
Oh God, it's the next thing. Yeah. Have you not seen it, Norm?
No.
Okay, we got to do it. We got to do a spoiler cast on this next. Because
yeah,
I'm only on episode 5.
Mm. It's only like eight, right?
Yeah. I'm on episode 5. They're 22 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Good.
They're little nuggets, yeah. And Natasha Lyonne is amazing.
Natasha Lyonne's very good.
It's a dark Groundhog Day.
Yeah, it is a dark Groundhog Day, and it's much deeper than that.
Okay.
Like, it goes to other places. I was talking to Test Zone Kalo yesterday on the phone, and she was pointing out that Natasha Lyonne's character is basically a man. Like, she has all these male attributes. When you watch it, you'll see. She has all these male attributes. She drinks too much. She sleeps around. You could easily pour it
traditionally
her role.
Male. Yeah.
Yeah. In a traditional drama comedy, because this is funny and it's really dark and it's really philosophical. It's fantastic. I'm really enjoying the spit out of it, and I still have 3 episodes to go.
When Ben Acker was here a couple episodes ago, we talked about one of his recommendations, which was Sex Education on
yes,
Netflix.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
I watched the first 2 episodes. It is fantastic.
It's really good.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
It almost reads like plays like a webcomic. Well, or not a graphic novel.
I didn't realize it was Gillian Anderson as the mom. It took me a long time to pick that up, and she is very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's totally worth watching.
Darren Criss was just tweeting about it this morning.
It's very fast paced, very funny.
They're short, too. It's like 20 minutes. 22.
How many episodes?
Is it an hour long? Oh, well,
I think 8
then.
Episodes.
8 episodes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Really, really good. You mentioned comfort movies. My comfort movies are not great movies. I put on comfort movies are the bad movies in the series that otherwise are great series. So, for example,
been watching a lot of Thor 2, The Dark World.
Yes.
Hey, that's not as bad as Thor.
I think Thor 2, The Dark World is demonstrably worse.
Oh, no.
Our book ended by Thor's.
Adam.
Now things come to light.
We've got to...
Indiana Jones 4.
Oh,
I know.
That's a comfort movie for
you? It is, because I've only seen it the once. And so now 10 years later, when it pops on, I will watch the whole thing and realize, oh, it's still a Spielberg film.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, right. Still,
right? And it's like, wow.
So again, speaking of Spielberg and comfort, I've been watching a whole bunch of old Every Frame a Painting by the great Tony Joe and his wife.
Yeah,
and I watched the Spielberg Wonder. So Tony points out that in he has a whole video devoted, I think it's called the Spielberg Wonder.
Yeah, I think so.
Where he talks about in the history of cinema, there's all this talk about great long shots like the opening of Touch of Evil and the Absolute Beginners and Goodfellas. And Tony points out that Spielberg has 1.5 to 2 minute shots in almost every one of his films, but he doesn't draw attention to them because they're just excellent storytelling devices. And he points out that the entire conversation with the mayor in Jaws takes place in a single shot where 2 cars arrive on the shore, people climb onto a barge, the barge travels across a bay all in a single shot.
I will say it's not the case with he works with Tom Cruise, because both the Wonders in Minority Report and War of the Worlds are glaring. And they are technical. They are like, look at what we can do with the camera here and move it through the car.
War of the Worlds. I've wanted to go back and rewatch War of the Worlds because I haven't seen
it. I was a big fan of that movie when it came out. I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it when I saw it in the theaters. I haven't watched it since, probably.
I've watched pieces of it. It was in a hotel recently. I mean, recently, within the last year and a half. And I watched pieces of it, and it's still,
great moments of tension.
Yeah.
The Tim Robbins scene. Yep.
That Tim Robbins stuff is really disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some Twilight Zone eeriness to it.
It seemed like it was kind of Steven Spielberg's dad phase. Like when he was working the dad feels real hard.
Listen, I'm a huge Tom Cruise apologist. Like, I love Tom Cruise. I think he commits to a deep degree and makes me enjoy his movies. And in that role is weirdly nondescript to me. Like, he plays a character who's out of touch with his family, and yet I don't even get a sense of family from him in the film.
Yeah.
And yet, still love that movie.
Dakota Fanning screams a lot.
Oh my gosh.
The one villain Tom Cruise couldn't defeat was family.
Hey everyone, Norm here. Before we continue with the conversation, I want to let you know that this week's episode of Still Untitled is made possible by Vistaprint. Whether you're a startup or a business with a century of history, being plugged in and prepared when an opportunity comes is crucial. Those moments happen all the time. And having a business card that shows how professional you are is the first step to making something happen. With Vistaprint, all it takes is $10 to create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. You'll have the confidence that you're always ready to make an impression and ready to own the now. Simply upload your own design or start with one of Vistaprint's professionally designed options and a wide range of templates. You pick your paper stock, your style, and quantity, and choose your delivery speed, and then you receive your cards in as few as 3 days with your satisfaction 100% guaranteed. Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at just $9.99. Use the code UNTITLED at Vistaprint.com. Again, that's the code UNTITLED at Vistaprint.com, UNTITLED at Vistaprint.com. And thank them for sponsoring this week's episode. Someone asked us this question on Twitter, and yeah. I'll propose it. I don't know if we've prepared for it, but what film that's not universally well received, I don't want to say bad films, mm-hmm. but what film would you want to remake?
So funnily enough, I retweeted Boots Riley recently about this because yeah. he was saying, oh, if I was going to remake a movie, I'd remake a terrible movie.
That's the right call. And why and go back and make
totally
something good
right
again?
The trick is that for a studio, it doesn't make sense to do a movie that was reviled. Like, no one's going to try and reboot the Remo Williams franchise or the Hudson Hawk franchise.
I don't care about the business aspect of this.
Right. Okay, so, I mean, of course, the first place my brain goes is to one of the all-time great terrible movies, which is Space Hunters, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone.
Oh. That's bad enough. I haven't
which
even
like
seen it.
Which is like Michael Ironside and Molly Ringwald. It's a mid-80s debacle. This is a movie that famously, when it was released, there's a shot of a spaceship landing on a planet's surface, and in the corner of the frame, you can see cars in the parking lot they were filming in. Like, at the,
wow.
there's like, you can see the edge wow. of frame, and you can
wow.
see, like, a car bumper.
Wow. It's but, good,
why would you want to choose that one? Is it
no,
because...
No, it's not that I want to choose that one. Really, the correct exercise, and this is one I've had trouble coming up with, which would be a premise that's great and super poorly executed.
Yeah.
That's what I think
like,
we're really
like
talking
the
about.
Thing that I miss are...
An
like,
unfulfilled premise.
Like the 50s giant ant insect movies, right?
Like
something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we kind of get that with monster movies now, with your Pacific Rims and your whatever, but they're you know, fantasy monsters, basically. Mm-hmm. I feel like a giant ants movie you could really do some work with today.
You know, I mean, it's. I remember a friend of mine talking about the original Men in Black. So the Men in Black series is a really interesting series because I happen to think the third movie in the series is the best one of the
is
three
that the
by
one,
far.
Is that the one with
time travel one
with the
Josh
Thanos
Brolin.
as
perfect casting.
Yeah, very perfect casting.
Yeah. Really dark and sweet and beautiful, and they didn't have a script. I remember talking to someone who worked
was
deeply on
the
production,
strike?
And they were as shocked as I was that the movie was great.
It nailed the landing, and it made the relationship, if you rewatch the first two films, made it stronger.
And but so going back to the first film, I remember a friend of mine saying, oh, Men in Black drags itself out of the muck just enough to make you angry it's not better.
I don't dislike the first movie.
So I don't. I find it okay, but not incredible. Like I didn't care as much about the characters as I wanted to.
The second one was the one that I like. It's been a really long time since I've seen any of
the
so
second
feel,
one's the one you like?
I
Johnny
think,
Knoxville?
Oh no. I must like the third one then. It's definitely not the Johnny Knoxville Laura
Flynn Boyle.
Laura Flynn Boyle, yeah.
You know, I briefly met Vincent D'Onofrio at the Mortal Engines premiere.
Is Vincent D'Onofrio is the first one, right?
The first one is Earl the Bug.
Yeah, Earl.
Edgar, right. Of course, he's good friends with Rick Baker because they spent hundreds of hours in makeup together.
Oh, God.
And so I was talking to Rick, and Vincent came over and introduced himself. I'm Vincent. And up until then, I'd seen him, and I kept on wondering, who's that really charismatic, handsome guy? I feel like I should know who that is.
It's the Kingpin.
It's Kingpin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The first look, so much of the first one is great, but I think that I'm talking about it as like I feel like the first one misses on a bunch of levels that would be great to remake, and I'm excited about the Tessa Thompson
Chris Hemsworth
reboot with Emma Thompson.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. Soft reboot. meaning
yeah, they're going to
in universe.
Yeah,
Liam Neeson. I mean, I love all these people.
I still wish they had made the Lord Miller crossover 21 Jump Street one.
Yeah,
where the 21 Jump Street guys get promoted to be Men in Black on the third.
Oh,
movie.
Really?
Yeah.
That was the rumor. It was part of the Sony leaks.
Oh, you know what Boots could really do would be the tie through between Home Alone and the Saw films.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
The fan theory
like
that
Kevin McAllister grows up to be Jigsaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
Boots. You should do it.
But what is the bad movie?
We're not letting you have a dagger during the podcast anymore. You're going to stab yourself in the leg in a minute. It's only a matter of time. You're making me very nervous.
It's not that sharp.
I realize that. But that was a. Anyway.
I would say Waterworld.
Waterworld.
Oh, man. Oh, no. But if you're going with the Kevin Costner post-apocalypse, the Postman is the way to go.
I've never seen The Postman.
Oh,
and I read it.
It's
and
so
still
good.
I never
it's
went
not so good. It's not so good.
Okay, so the David Brin short story is very, very good.
It's not a short story. It's a full novel.
Is it a full novel?
It is.
I thought it was a novella.
It might be a novella, but it's certainly more than a short story.
Look, David Brin books are usually like 6-pounders. Anything.
Oh, anything
less
that's
than
like
Earth.
250 pages.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what the line is. But yeah, The Postman I read. I like the movie The Postman, even though it is very poorly executed.
There's a guy named Ford Lincoln Mercury.
Look, Ford Prefect is one of the greatest characters in modern fiction. But
you're right. The Postman had a lot of potential. That kind of post-apocalypse, what it takes to rebuild the idea of America in that world.
So it's interesting that as we're thinking of unfulfilled premises, we keep thinking of these giant films that were science fiction films, right? So inherently difficult to make if the film, the original, failed. I think that if we really want to indulge in this exercise, and I'm not saying that we're ready to do this, but it's worth talking about. If we really want to indulge in this exercise, we should look for films like small dramas with unfulfilled premises, because those would be much easier to remake.
Then you could lift that drama and put it in a science fiction setting, and it's even better.
Yes.
Bam.
Wow.
Producers.
So anyone writing this down, someone should pay us a lot of money for this shit.
Yeah, this is consulting.
Hey, you started talking about comfort movies and watching Casino Royale, which is the first of the
rebooted Bond films starring Daniel Craig.
Daniel Craig, which is directed by Martin Campbell, who directed Goldeneye. So he did the
terrific. Casino Royale is my favorite Bond film. It's my favorite, I'm saying it, it's my favorite Bond film. And I've loved everything after Quantum of Solace.
You're talking about all the Bond films.
Yeah.
You know which one's my favorite? My favorite's George Lansby.
Yeah.
Really?
It's so good. I'm with Norm on this.
Yeah.
Better than... I'm sorry, but if you showdown watching those two back-to-back, you'd choose Casino Royale.
But you have to put them in the context of their time. And
no, no, I don't.
Okay. I do. You don't. Do whatever the hell you want. I feel like... Lazenby's was such a departure from Connery and set such a unique tone. It was a real bummer that they sacked him and hired Roger Moore. Yeah.
He only did the one.
Yeah.
And he bridged it beautifully, the production design.
There's character development, the whole thing.
Yes, it's the one he falls in love.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah.
It's Diana Riggs.
His wife dies. I know. Yeah. I know.
Is murdered. She doesn't die.
They ski. There's one more Daniel Craig Bond film coming out, and I think director is Cary Fukunaga, who did directed the whole first season of True Detective.
Oh, okay.
I think he was the one that was going to direct the It film. He did Child Soldiers movie for Netflix, A Beast of Something Nation. But my point is, who was going to direct the Bond film was Danny Boyle. Director of Slumdog Millionaire,
Trainspotting,
28 Days Later. And instead, he left that project.
Sunshine?
He did Sunshine as well.
Which I've never seen.
It's good. The first two-thirds are great. That's the popular. That's the common wisdom.
That's what I hear.
I want to remake that film.
That is a good remake. The other way, I'd remake The Fountain, too.
The Fountain, Darren Aronofsky.
I couldn't wrap my head around that one.
Rachel Weisz.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Danny Boyle, instead of making that film, has another film coming out, which a trailer dropped, I think, yesterday.
Last night, late.
Called Yesterday.
Which is the greatest. I was just watching the trailer this morning while you were setting up the gear. This is one of my favorite premises I've ever heard. And it reminded me of Squid and the Whale when Jesse Eisenberg plays the Pink Floyd song that no one in his high school knows is Pink Floyd because no one knows Pink Floyd. And he passes it off as his own. So the premise of Yesterday is genius.
Yeah, it's the last man on earth.
No, it's a science fiction story, ostensibly, where the conceit is this aspiring artist, struggling musician, wakes up in the world where no one remembers and knows about the Beatles, and then takes and accidentally takes credit for.
I don't think it's accidental.
Well, he struggles with it. It seems like in the trailer.
It seems like he has a moral dilemma early that's resolved relatively quickly.
Yes. We don't know. We don't know how this plays out.
But it is wish fulfillment. Everyone has had this kind of fantasy.
Right. So imagine if you woke up and all of a sudden you're like, "Yesterday," and everyone's like, "Wow, that's a great song." You're like, yeah.
"When did you write this?"
So here's part that I'm wondering is if it happened to me.
Yeah.
There'd be Beatles songs. I'm getting a little ticking in my ear here. That's fine. Probably. It's gone. It may be because I cut through the mic cord.
Probably. All the stabbing.
There'd be Beatles songs in which I'd remember the lyrics wrong. Yeah. So I'm wondering if they're going to put that as a plot point in
dude.
The film.
But I think what resonates with this trailer, one, it's the Beatles, right? Like the songs the soundtrack for this movie is going to be awesome because it's just going to be the Beatles' greatest hits album.
Sung by somebody else.
Totally fine. Yeah. It's wish fulfillment. We've all had this kind of fantasy of like, you know, what it would be like to put in that. And it also just shows the enduring power of those songs.
Yeah.
To put them in a modern context.
I saw Jeff Tweedy speak at City Arts and Lectures a couple weeks ago. And someone said, "Who's your favorite band?" And his response was so amazing. He said, "I don't know. Is it possible to have another favorite band besides the Beatles? I mean, they sort of invented the whole concept of having a favorite band." And I'm like, wow.
That's so true.
Totally true. Speaking of music, a couple things happened. The Super Bowl happened since the last we talked to each other.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And not that that was significant to me because I didn't watch the game, but as part of all of the folderol about who was going to play the halftime show, I went back and watched Prince's halftime show for the Super Bowl in, I think, 2004.
They should have just stopped after him.
Dude. That is, if you want some really awesomeness right now, go call it up. It's like 25 minutes long, and Prince just schools the whole world on how to do a great set with some of his own songs, some other amazing songs. Foo Fighters, Jimi Hendrix worked their way in there. It is a killer.
There's the nice thing about that is once you watch that on YouTube, it's going to fill your recommended feed with a bunch of other live Prince shows.
Right.
There's the Prince performance at Bob Dylan's 25th anniversary concert in Madison Square Garden. I think it's 25th.
Really?
It's the one that closes with like Kris Kristofferson and Eric Clapton and a bunch of old guys playing. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
He plays at that and it is astounding. Like it's just
amazing.
And he's like, it's like in 93 or 92 or something probably. So he's,
kills me.
He's young and he just comes out in Wales. There's the one where at the end he just throws the guitar up in the air and it never comes down. Like still don't know. Like I assume that there's some poor bastard hanging from the rafters.
Well, when you watch him on the Super Bowl, there's like, you know, trap doors opening up in the stage and people handing him tuned guitars in pouring rain everything works. I also watched behind the scenes about that Super Bowl. There's like literally water's pouring into all their equipment and there's no malfunctions. But the moment the performance is over, everything stops working.
So I have a friend who is a producer for that show, for the Super Bowl halftime show every year. And she said that people don't know the half of that one.
When
it rains like that, it's just who knows how it's going to like they're all just dying the entire time.
Is there a documentary about the production of that?
That would be a great seven days
behind the scenes. It's about 30 minutes long of it that I just watched on YouTube.
Okay.
But also the Grammys happened a few days ago. And I learned two things from those. Alicia Keys is maybe one of the great humans of the world.
She seems really good.
Her hosting of that show was so magnificently grounded and balanced and loving and artistic and maternal and a warrior. It was just phenomenal. And Brandi Carlile did a song. She sang The Joke. Just off of her new album. And I'm obsessed with Brandi Carlile lately because I can't stop listening to The Mother. Listen to The Mother. It's incredible. But Brandi Carlile sang, and her song is incendiary and amazing and really worth going and watching.
Speaking of awards shows.
Yes.
Can we talk about the Academy Awards for a moment?
Sure.
Isn't it coming up in like a
week? Oh, yeah.
And the fact that they're not putting the fucking cinematography editing and
not quite
and
not quite
they're doing it during commercials
they're doing those during commercials but they are going to cut them down and put them into the regular broadcast. This is what they
I'm live
just,
editing.
I'm just making sure that we have our terms
I didn't know
straight.
That part, so I'm glad, so you, I, glad
because,
you clarified.
Guillermo, I follow Guillermo del Toro on Twitter, and he was very vocal about saying these, you know, cinematography and editing are not ancillary to film. They are, he says, they are cinema itself.
The core
process. These
are
the two things that don't exist in, right? But then apparently there's some elaboration that they're going to cut those award receptions down and put them in the regular broadcast. They're just not going to air them live,
so,
which is still problematic and bullshit.
So look,
I agree.
Hey, which acceptance speeches are people who aren't famous enough for people to be excited about?
Right.
So which can we cut down to 10 seconds?
Right. But bah. I mean, I would always want to watch Roger Deakins finally getting his
Anytime.
Oscar like we got to last year.
If Roger Deakins got his Oscar this year and they cut the acceptance speech down,
dude,
oh
my God,
I would
get
throw
very stabby right
TV.
Away.
I think they're going to, I mean, I can only imagine they're cutting it down the same way that they show a montage for the technical awards.
Yeah. I don't know what they're planning, but this is a terrible idea.
I mean, then it's just like 5 seconds of saying, watching someone say thank you, and that's
here's it. Here's a statue. Here's somebody we don't recognize. We don't know why they're here. Oh. Blah.
I think this betrays this kind of central thing about, you know, the Academy let so much film history drift through its hands into private collections, and there's so many pieces of film history we don't know where they are anymore. And wonderful people, friends of Tested, like Deborah Nadulman Landis, have worked hard to bring that to the fore and explicate it and educate about it.
And document it.
Yeah. And this feels like another case of the Academy not valuing what is actually special about what it is promoting. And
I think
that's
exactly
the thing
that
feels so sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least they're not doing those new commercial inserts. Have you seen this? Like, I for the Super Bowl, it said to watch TV and not do it on demand. But now they cut from a live event to do like half the screen is your
show. I haven't seen that.
And half the screen is a commercial. And it's like a picture-in-picture commercial. There's a way to get more commercials in during your live
content.
Look,
I'll watch 2 minutes of commercial. I'll watch 5 minutes of commercials ahead of the broadcast if I don't have to have those in the...
Those are no good because you're not thinking about it. You're not really focused. You're not on the edge of your seat waiting for
Ringo.
Hey, it's where they dropped that Endgame trailer in the Super Bowl. It's the very first commercial
Endgame
that came
trailer?
Out. Avengers Endgame.
I'm not watching them. I'm not watching those trailers. Although I did watch half of Infinity War the other night, as part of watching.
That's a comfort movie.
Like when I want comfort movies, the Marvel section on my Plex server is pretty much where I go first. It turns out because Winter Soldier, you can always watch Winter Soldier.
Winter Soldier. By the way, if you haven't watched Winter Soldier, it's amazing. If you haven't watched it again in a while,
it's really good.
Still perfect.
Anyway.
That's as good as place any to wrap it up.
there's a lot of culture this week.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of, yeah.
Let's talk about the Academy Awards after it airs.
Is it next weekend? Is it this weekend? I haven't watched the Academy Awards in so long. I kind of don't want to start now. I don't want to encourage them.
Twitter will let me know.
That's the thing. All I want to know is who wins. And if there's a good acceptance speech, you know, that's good too. See y'all next week. Norm, what's on the site this week? Anything?
We're putting up Adam's King Arthur armor build.
Ooh,
on
yes!
YouTube.
Finally!
So, yeah,
oh, that hasn't gone up yet?
Yeah, so I think
it's been behind the paywall.
Fifth episode. So hope you enjoyed that. And we'll have some other stuff.
I'm actually finally fixing the armor this morning.
Oh, cool.
It's been a year. It's been a year.
Yeah. It's kind of, I mean, anyway.
It's been a year and a half. That was the summer of 2017,
yes. But it's been a year since you used it in the short film.
Yeah. I wanted to say that after we talked about the right stuff with Jen Schachter last week, my mom found the copy that was sitting on the bookshelf in our house since I was a child and sent it to me.
Is it the silver one or the white one?
Yeah,
it's the silver one with the flag on the front?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I had that one too.
So she said, my mom sent it off to me. Thank you, Mom. I know she's listening. I'm going to start reading it right after I'm done with, reading a book about, the illusion of the self.
Okay. For a future episode.
It's a powerful illusion, but it's an illusion nonetheless.
See y'all next week.
Thanks, guys. Right.
Bye.
Oh, hey, didn't see you there. Well, now that I have you here, I want to remind you that our newest Tested t-shirt is available for just a couple more days. It's our new logo shirt, an exploded diagram designed in partnership with Those Nerdy Design Sketches, and it's available until Monday on tested.com/shop. Picking up this shirt allows us to keep on working on model making projects, going to events, and supports us in general. Thank you so much for watching our videos, and hope you get this shirt. See ya.